How's everyone doing? I'm Sam. I've been here for the past 6 weeks as an artist in residence, writing some music. And I had originally planned to do like a more formal presentation today, but then I woke up this morning and I was just like, I just want to play some songs. So I've got a handful of songs, and there's going to be some wonderful people joining me, and some of them I wrote here, some of them I wrote before, one of them is not mine. Actually, that's what I'm going to start with. Yeah, and with that, we'll just begin. Of a reinterpretation. So it's an old Appalachian folk tune that a songwriter named Sam Amidon sort of took the words and bits of the melody and turned into something, and then I rearranged his arrangement. So it's Maybe someone will rearrange my rearrangement of the rearrangement, and we'll see. Cool. So this next one is going to involve Justine on some cello, and Angela is going to sing some harmonies, and Samo is going to play guitar. And this one is pretty fresh. It's been maybe a week old or something. Less than a week, I think, actually. Wait, no, you're not. Go ahead. I've got an extra copy of the word.
Oh, nice.
Marta and I. And Sam, yes, on the drums. So this song I wrote maybe a month before I came to Holden, and it's there's a movie called To All the Boys I Loved Before, which is a Netflix original, and it's one of those really cheesy like high school rom-com things. You know, and there's like the literal boy who lives next door, but then like it never works out because they're always like in different places in life, even though they literally live next to each other. So that's kind of where this song comes from.
Sorry, which song is this?
This one?
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Sometimes, you know, Sam's done. He's ready. Oh, no. Oh, he's also thirsty.
One, two, three.
Okay. Well, once more with feeling.
Thank you.
Thanks for letting us get a second shot at that on account of me. Then, oh, Marta, you left, but you need to be here. So Rolf and Angela and Marta are going to join me at the end of this one. If y'all want one of these, I got one somewhere. Yeah. So this one is also new and it's written here at Holden, and it's sort of about the sensation of searching for something and realizing some point down the line that what you were looking for was there the whole time, and that despite that, you may never have found it were it not for the journey anyway. So, yeah.
Down my
Thank you. Thanks to Rolf and Martin and Angela. This next one, I'm moving over to the piano, and I need Samo.
How are you doing?
A watch. There's a watch.
There's a watch?
Need a clock.
Well, does the wall wear a watch?
It's not worried.
It's okay, I just spilled it myself.
I didn't.
Thanks for making me feel better.
Yeah, it was that song.
Okay.
Let's, no, I can't, Sam, I can't do it like this. I'm tired of playing with my back to you.
I need to see your pretty face.
Well, that could be another song. Let's work on that later, okay?
Just want to see.
So, a bunch of people have probably heard this song a bunch of times by now. It was the first one I wrote since I've been in Holden. And it's about those liminal spaces that we've been talking about so much. And, yeah, I think it was autobiographical because I'm going through some transitions in my life, but also kind of about Holden as a place where people can come to be in transition, to heal, and to sort of sort out next steps on whatever paths they might be on. And so that's sort of where this song comes from. Which I need Asaph and Rolf and Angela.
Never
Do you want to sit over there, or do you want to be a little closer? This is the wrong guitar. It's the wrong trousers from it.
They're gone wrong.
Just crackers about cheese. So this last one is a song I wrote actually a while ago. It's dedicated to my grandmother, whose name was Helen, and also to my dog when I was growing up, whose name was Issa. And that's the title of the song, is Issa. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much to everyone who just helped me do all that. It was really special. And I just want to extend the warmest and biggest thank you I possibly can to Holden and everyone who I've met and who supported me while I've been here. It's been really special. And and now you won't have to hear from me for a while. So. thank you. Where do you want to be? How can I help you make this make sense?
This makes sense.
Yeah.
Stop. Do you know the album Stop Making Sense?
By the Talking Heads.
That's the one. That's all. This is, it's interesting lighting. I can't even tell. Who's that? Is that Marissa? No, that, I mean, the lighting was great. I could read for sure. But it, so I, can everybody hear my voice?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Do you want, I can mic you though.
No, that's just fine.
Okay.
It'll be good. I like just being able to speak. We saw a bear today. Did anybody raise your hand if you saw a bear today? Woo! Raise your hand if you saw more than one bear today.
Wow.
How many, Cedar, how many, with a show of fingers, how many bears did you see today? Can you raise that high? In this, way up there. Sky is the limit. Can you show everybody? Yeah, that's three bears, if you can't see. Three bears in one day. That's a pretty lucky day. And the bear interrupted my a letter I was writing out of, I was working on this typewriter letter, and then Marta came in and was like, "Mother Bear," and I ran, and it was incredibly majestic. I go around the corner and I'm, and things are like in slow motion rushing by me, and then Cedar's like points like that. And the bear literally climbs up onto the boulder and poses like that and looks at us and then climbs back down and we hear its children, which sound a lot like humans, mm-hmm. human children, really, really bizarre. And my grandpa always kind of gave me this idea that bears were people. I told a story a couple weeks back about my grandpa's bear dreams, so I won't repeat that story. But have I already told you all the story about the bear up Ross Creek?
Yeah.
I told John, maybe. Okay. So instead of doing everything like I plan to do, I'm going to tell a story, and then I might read some poems and talk about what I've been working on. I told Jim at his headstone in Libby, Montana, I said, "I'm trying to find your bear. I'm trying to find your bear, the one from your dreams." And all the other headstones were buried under snow. It was 6 degrees under. And I had cleared away the snow from his headstone. I knew it because my mom has a little wrought iron star that she buried above his headstone so we could find it in the winter. When I say, "Jim, I'm trying to find your bear," these words come into my mind. Just turn around in a circle. Just look around in a circle. And months later, in that same part of Montana, I'm a backcountry ranger. And I'm on my last patrol. Kind of like today was the last day of my residency. So my last patrol up Ross Creek. Has anybody ever been to Libby, Montana, by the way? Can I see a show? Has anybody ever been to Libby?
Yeah.
Okay, does anybody know the Ross Creek Cedars? They're probably the oldest cedars in Montana. And they're in a real tight drainage in the Scotchman Peaks proposed wilderness area where I was patrolling. What that means is I carried a couple tools, and my job was to clear out the trees that had fallen across the trail when I could, and then report back to my boss about what the conditions were like. When I got there, it was early in the morning,
And I saw a great horned owl immediately, which for some reason filled me with this feeling of omen, and I couldn't shake it. And the trail wound through the old growth cedars and then eventually went around a corner and crossed the creek, and then it was lost in last year's burn. It was all fireweed. Anybody know what that's like when you're walking through fireweed and it's 6 feet tall and it's almost over your head and you can't see anything? It's just fuchsia. It's like you're walking through the birth of a star. And when the wind comes through, the fireweed moves and you think you hear something behind you. At least that's what I was constantly fighting. There's something behind me. There's something that's chasing me. There's something that's been chasing me for a while. That's what I'm starting to realize. There's something that chased my grandpa all the way up until that final dream he had where the bear caught him on the operating table. And I can't figure out, what is this thing? I can't get any work done. For some reason, it just doesn't make sense to saw it. It doesn't make sense to hack at soil and dust and ash. And so I just give in. And I say, I'm done. I'll come back tomorrow. So I start hiking out, and this feeling builds on me. You're being followed. You're being watched. It's going to get you. It's right there behind you in the fireweed. And I said, stop telling me what's behind me. There's nothing behind me. And I sat down at the creek on a boulder, and I'm watching the water. And you know when you watch water for so long that when you look up, the trees bend with the current, as if your eyes have just caught the current and the trees bend. And these old growth cedars, older than colonization, are bending in front of me. And I get that same old feeling that I've had for so long, which is I just wish I could be this place. I wish I could be this place. And then the next words that come out of my mouth are, I wish I could see a bear. And I pick up my Pulaski and my backpack and I turn around and there's a bear. A yearling. That tall, maybe. Not bigger than a Labrador. Just looking at me. And of course I said a cuss word and the bear ran. And I waited because it was young enough to have a mom around, but there was no mother around. Trying to find your bear, Jim. Justine, you have that photo?
Yes.
That's okay. Just hold on to it. Trying to find your bear. Trying to move from one space to another. What's that mean, that passage or migration? That's what I emailed Holden Village when Travis Houle told me to apply. He said, you've been talking a lot about salmon and migration. You've been wanting to go down to the border, to Sonora, and understand what a wall means. You've been wanting to understand what a dam means, blocking fish passage. You've been trying to figure out what's holding you back from a sense of belonging, return to the headwaters. What does migration mean? What does it mean to say, I just want to be this place? I just want to be this place. Let me see a bear. And then the last day, how many bears did we see? That's three. This piece is about the dreams that I've had for years about being in my childhood creek, which is changing. And in real life, the creek is really, really thin. It goes down to just a few inches in the summer, and there's culverts that atomize the creek. Culverts, they impede fish migration. So if salmon were ever in this creek, they're not there anymore. But in the dreams, miraculous things happen. And Thomas Merton, who I've been reading while I've been here, describes the miraculous as mercy. And then says mercy is inconsistency. I love that. Inconsistency being illogic. Something that doesn't fit into the scheme of how we perceive the world. So Jesus' birth into the world was this incredibly inconsistent, illogical phenomenon. An immaculate birth. The birth of compassion and love in a time of extreme violence and fear and hate. So this piece has a tentative title called Culvert Prayers, which might change, might not. Started off with a quote by Merton that is, "Mercy is inconsistent. It is therefore comic." I'm just going to read a few pieces from this and then maybe go to some other poems. Water through slats, out of view, the dream is a film. Nobody's here, not even Connor. Punctuating the static, voices rise into chants you couldn't translate. Spruce and amber flare through the waterfall, focusing as hundreds of salmon and steelhead. They're leaping into the culvert, merging into water. There's a break. Dad points at creek, his other hand on his mouth. I gaze beyond sandbags and young, caged willows. Chinook school around the bathing woman in the eddy. They're silver, just arrived from the Pacific. They can't tell which way is upstream. Stop, Dad yells. The woman looks at him, then morphs into an orca. She bursts through the pod, herding them under cut banks. Creek spreads into estuary, ocean. I don't know how to console him. Cedar crosses to the unfinished house, the door caged in wrought iron. English ivy caves the shed, spilling tar shingles, window panes, a crowbar. Two culverts lie uninstalled in the bed. We take turns climbing feeders, making canyons from goalies. The fender we eat carrots and sourdough on was left by the teenager who couldn't handle the curve. We cup hands to the spill and wipe them on undersides of ferns. Through the stands, the pink stucco begins to hover. German shepherds scatter gravel. We run. Chinook alone, mercury on clay. There must be an opening, a way home through the culverts. I carry the body through the understory. Among houses, it's immaculately out of place. Airplane in wilderness. An invisible creek runs from the garage down the driveway. I lay the salmon over the blacktop. Scaled vellum and musculature slough away, eddying around the cul-de-sac. Craft earrings, the vertebrae ask, but a white couch appears before them. I use it to rise, staining handprints, Sitka and Roe. Near the headwaters, it's clear and deep enough. Old-growth firs rising from silt and ash. I'm going downstream to find a chainsaw, I say. No, Mom says, you're looking for salmon. The dorsal arcs, aiming for the lip. Halfway, I brace against the trunk and yell. Nobody's here. Creosote down my shoes, a crushed beer can in my back pocket. I stare into current for so long the alders bend. The camera is useless. I turn my palms over, but the body doesn't return to the surface. This is not a dream. The second piece that I worked on while I was here was, which I've showed many times before, and maybe I'll pass it around one more time. It's, a hobby I have is finding decomposing salmon and printing them with charcoal. And I wrote poems on five cross-sections of a chum salmon I found in the headwaters of the Skagit, just on the other side of the mountains. I'm going to read some of these poems, but the collection is actually for a museum. Not like I'm not asking for it to be put in a museum. I'm actually just going to send it to them like a gift and see what happens. It's a museum that's been deeply effective in translating a story of colonization and a story of resilience. So I wrote this letter to the Macaw Museum in Nia Bay, and the poems in this piece describe my returns to the Olympic Peninsula with my family and with my friends, and seeing a story emerging in that landscape. So I'll read the letter and then maybe a couple poems. Gift for the Macaw Museum. We arrive unannounced at the doors of the cultural center. The curator says, two landslides, just cut the power. She invites us in, the first visitors since the outage. From Poland, my friend Ivona asks me to translate the exhibits. I whisper, stone that distracts great white sharks, but my commentary feels weightless. I can't speak for what's around us, so I begin listening. Gull colonies loop from stereos. Someone we can't see is drumming inside the longhouse. We read images slowly. Woodpecker feather blankets, cedar dorsals inlaid with otter teeth and opercula. Shrapnel washed up from shipwrecks. Parade queens riding the old Chevy's bed. The Macaw Museum invokes us to translate the animate traditions that weave around us. Ivona points to the basket with American flags. Kush, she says. I look it up in her yellow two-way dictionary. Kush, basket. The women who spent winters spiraling bear grass, sedge, and raffia into grocery credit at Washburn's. These weavers threaded whales beside flags. Their containers don't hide colonialism's warp. Beside them, we become aware of our implicitness and the oppression of cultural, physical, and spiritual sovereignty. With resilience, remembrance, and humor, women stitched the patterns that hold Nia Bay. Driving home on 101, I see a story emerging in the land and realize it too deserves a container. The chum salmon spawned up my local creek becomes the basket. I print his just passed body using charcoal from the fireplace and type poems in soot ink on the old royal typewriter. Some words come out blurry, hinting at the smoke that clouds around translations. From the salmon's tail to the head, these poems craft a figurative migration. The meditations in Far Northwest and Chinook Room Columbia House spark returns to the Olympic Peninsula. Road to Forks recounts driving to Nia Bay and learning from Ivona about her childhood in Soviet Poland. Basket with American flags details our walk through the museum. And translations concludes the migration with a leap in the surf at Suyes Beach. The salmon as a whole is named translations. Its story begins in Nia Bay. It left, grew, and is asking to be returned. Whoever it lands with, I offer it as a gift in honoring of the museum's labor gone into weaving. My hope is that translations serves as a reminder to witness the stories that spiral around us. With care, Sam Olson, delivered to P.O. Box 160, Nia Bay, Washington, 98357. Far Northwest, the tale. Pumped beneath the 76, the creek still feeds the estuary, scalps lagging through unstrung pulleys, kelp tangled in the slack. Trunks spine trunks, the bay pooling with stripped second growth, half ceiling, half floor. Believe them that forests begin on knees, stand, and hike to the ocean. Jetty, meaning throne, becomes diving board, where the egg-shaped silo drains sawdust. Stray cats crisscross driftwood, and the heron lifts away when you call. Tagging the cuts, the wedge between habitat and commodity. Who are we, trees or the logo of trees? Out here, far northwest, dogs, ravens are being carved before advertisement. Road to Forks, which is the dorsal. Down the oxidized, rained-on bridge, saplings furl from pilings. Ask about childhood in Poland. Yellow cottonwood leaves pack into the gravel quarry. Furs strike uniform down the ditches. clear cut 1910, next cut 19, numbers catch in the boughs. Beyond silver-tipped second growth, the blue-trimmed steel headers lodge, aluminum warehouse, the hoe glares. Roosevelt elk revolve into old spruce. The red cabin crests with ivy. Brush my hair, it pulls out. That's how far fallout travels. Right up Big Cedar Road, circle the mother trunk, huckleberries trumpeting from the scours, heels into trampoline duff, hands in barkless grooves, Eiffel Tower means nothing. Here's the head. Translations. Headlights thatching shore pines, think Montana, state with ocean once. Down the ruts, the permit swings from the rearview mirror, slides across the dash. Sand braces like permafrost up to the surf. You, staring at the bay, branch flexed into a hook, dorsal inlaid with cabin windows, say it's caving in on itself. The floor swells, sparks off our ankles, racing behind us, surging into our tracks, erasing them. Translations spiral all around us. So those poems were typed on the old Royal typewriter that Barbara had. Finally, after Justine had to pray to St. Anthony, was it? Pretty incredible. I've been looking for this thing for a week. I was about to go up into the upstairs of the VC to find it. And then Justine's like, oh, I'll just pray to St. Anthony.
Yes.
And then Barbara sits down and I'm like, hey, do you have the typewriter? Just like, on a whim. And she's like, oh yeah, go get it anytime. Thanks, Barbara and Justine and St. Anthony. Maybe I'll just say this now before I read these last poems. The typewriter is going to, unless other folks, Barbara, wherever you, if you're here, or if you have a different plan for it, that's okay. My hope for it, though, is that it can become a communal tool for Holden Village as a way to express ourselves. Using the ink from our fires reminds me a lot of when Merton says that Prometheus could never have stolen fire from the gods, could never be punished for stealing fire from the gods, because the fire already belonged to Prometheus, and the fire was his own spiritual freedom, which can never be stolen, but is something given to you and can never be taken away. To write with that spiritual freedom, it was an incredible gift and was incredibly fun. And if you want to take a look at how they turn out on these poems here, they're pretty evocative. And sometimes you can't read what you wrote, which is also really interesting when you try to read the poem in front of a crowd. These last poems are drafts, but this is what I've been working on for the last about 2 weeks or so. One of them is about being with Ivona and my Uncle Johan near the Salish Sea. And my Uncle Johan is a Vietnam veteran. He was a helicopter pilot. The title of this poem is called Pilot. Rain walks over them, the frenzied sugas in the spotlight. Up mussel beds, oyster lots, split bricks, the inlet braids and swells. They drive Mud Bay to the laundromat. Limbs pitch down the skylight and rack into the gutter. I build a fire from cedar shingles and microwave the tea. She climbs the loft and plays Polish news. He asks to bring us to the cinema. Eagle plummets beneath the boom, and the room is cloud. These last poems that I'm going to read are poems that I've been trying to write for a really long time, and they're back to Libby, back to headwaters. Gutney River is one of the major headwater tributaries of the Columbia River, which I grew up near the delta of the Columbia River in the Willamette and Portland, Oregon. So the Kootenai is this headwater space where my grandfather was born and where he's buried. And I moved to Montana just to be closer to that place. Deep cedar green water, and ponderosas, and Douglas firs, and a lot of vermiculite that became asbestos, and trees that became studs and clear cuts. And, a lot of pain and a lot of joy in that place. So these last three poems that I'll read to you is hopefully, they're going to be really bizarre, I bet, because they're pretty place specific, but I'll understand that they're part of that last stretch of the homeward migration, that last tributary to climb before Salmon returns home. This poem is called They Carry. They carry mason jars, how light recedes to the bulrushes. Dusked bonnets with matching aprons, they cross the highway to the harvest grocery. Ribbons fall from the seals, green flags over the blacktop, their ritual eddying around them. Herons drink shade and stilt through glare into the last place before Montana that sells color film. This poem is called Lake Creek, Montana. The ladder swinging in the canopy, whoever hung it there knows. On cedar shakes above my sleeping bag is a Chinook, enameled blue. I hear leaves and comet awake, tributaries removed. Dreams are for climbing. This last poem that I'll read to you is called I See You, Origin River. It's called I See You, Origin River. The teen bikes between headstones, dahlias on wrought iron stems. Raven lofts to thunderheads. The crosscut casino bars neon through tents and snowberry. Rain on my rainfly, diesel generators revving down. Idaho becomes vanishing point. Now both sides of firs say Pacific. You are all wonderful people. Thank you.
Hi. I'm going to start out by reading a poem that I read at the Art at Cascades presentation. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about poetry and my experiences here, and then I'll read two more poems. Christina's World, after Wyeth. I feel every grass scratch in the field. I yield to them. They yield to me. I feel the aftermath of dirt making indelicate my limp dress. I'm making a mess of myself, yes, but to crawl like this, to digress the limbs in a cower outstretched like a tigress stalking, or at least palm after palm, part infant, part pet. I have yet to consider the aerial view, the rarest human vantage point on plane with the hawk. I'm a vulnerable pack of flesh waiting for the beak to talon pickup. In my path, a plethora of stalks have snapped and stippled. No apologies for that. And no apologies for this. My lines leave a trail behind. The brittle elastics of straw half bounce back and slacken. Such is the embroidery of a dragged body, living or dead, like grazing. I alter the landscape. I pass brazen like a deadweight rainstorm cloud by fuscous rodents and metallic insects. I wreak havoc on intermittent anthills. I flatten an enterprise in seconds. There is no architect here. Barns are raised to be barns, and in them I put my livestock in. They live there, altar to the land, illuminating, fattening. At stake for me is meat and milk, something as murky as the word miracle. At stake for them is grass and grains, the lingering of the killing knife. I'm not tired. The trajectory is interjectional, sliced like a bleach of gold leaf in the black of sleep. Such is the scenic route. It's the same as the shortcut. The sun makes my underlids lactose as titanium white when I undercut my eyes. I'm in a place like the place where the eyes go when they're closed. It's hollow. It's like to live in a squint, a bird bone. Let it sink in, a louse to the mind, pounced upon. The crawl space is endless, this here to which I'm inhered. Every blink is a bold move, to return to the expansive field as if it's filled with my eyelashes and a shield of drowning light. Farther afield are the thoughts I feel rather than think. I yield to them. They yield to me. In pink, I reach the house. From my earliest encounters with poetry, I've been drawn to poetry that isn't immediately accessible, poetry that makes me return to it again and again, poetry that through rich, evocative, and inventive language probes the mysteries of our existence, but perhaps never fully answers them. The poems I'm most drawn to cannot exist in different words than the ones the poet chose. I often discover something new upon each rereading. I find they teach me a great deal, but I'm not always sure that I can say what I've learned. Sometimes I can only feel it. When I taught college-level creative writing, I would tell my students that there's a didactic expression that says, write what you know. There's also an expression that says, write what you don't know. There's yet another expression that says, write to find out what you know. I thought I might take that a bit further to add there's a kind of knowledge that can only be encountered through the act of writing. And yet, this knowledge often comes through the form of questioning. I had a lovely conversation with Adrienne a few days ago, and she asked, why do my poems always have questions in them? I love this question because I think it speaks to why so many people turn to poetry with the need to know something that they don't already know, or perhaps that they do already know, but haven't yet been able to put into words. It's through poetry that we try to put into words our relationship with mystery. Because we often aren't content with living in mysteries, there's a friction there, and in that friction, art is often the result. The poems that I'm drawn to the most don't answer the big questions, they dwell in them, and through this lived asking of questions, they manage to speak truths about our existence. While I've been at Holden, I haven't produced a lot of work, but I've been asking questions relevant to my work as a poet and a visual artist, as well as questions about community, spirituality, and about being an ethical human being while living on a planet that we are ruining. Admittedly, I've felt like I've mostly been a very simplified version of myself, and I don't know that that's been conducive to my writing process, but at the same time, I've learned a lot, and I've been able to make some breakthroughs along the way, as well as find a great deal of inspiration in my experiences here. Sometimes these experiences have directly made it into my work. For example, I had the pleasure of giving Angela's charming father a drawing lesson, and while I was drawing that day, I kept trying to come up with ways that I could condense the essentials of my drawing knowledge into an hour-long lesson. And while I was doing that, I came up with the idea of incorporating some of the well-known classical drawing tropes, such as the grid and facial structure exercises, into the actual drawing I was making. That sort of spontaneity with my drawing compositions isn't something I've been doing in the recent past, and it's something that I've wanted to do while I was here. Another example, my reading in the vagina monologues. Hi, John. gave me an idea to write and perform a one-woman play. I've been thinking that I need to do something wildly different in between finishing my first manuscript of poetry and starting my second manuscript, and a play might just be the thing. Okay, so I'm going to read two poems from my first manuscript. I usually try to stick with more accessible poems, but I decided tonight I might want to read a more difficult one. The next poem uses some references to Greek mythology. So Orpheus was a musician, poet, and prophet, and he and his instrument, the lyre, are representative symbols of poetry. There's a lot of anxiety about technology in this poem, and perhaps it enacts the fear that a technological voice will overtake our own. Here are some questions that the poem considers. How do you search for a poetic voice in a world that wishes to quell such a voice? What does living in a virtual world with increasing dependency on technology do to our own voices? What has it done to human knowledge and our perception of the finite and infinite? Does technology make being in the present impossible? So, food for thought, I guess. Okay, because the next two poems are very visual, I decided I would project them while I read them. Search engine. I search for lyre. Its entire history loads in seconds. I look at the stronghold of strings, listen to the dire sound. Discursive, I turn back to the original image. This leads me on a search for Orpheus. As yet, I can morph nothing into an amulet, or I loaf. Guided by the glitz of the infinite scroll, I ogle the go-round of found objects puts before me in their chintz of click here, come here, a crystalline come hither, all veil. To be fair, I leer here. I stare with the blank air of an absentee. The screen has me outdanced in a dim-witted but well-lit whirl. Voila. To veer off, I'm more of a sightseer. I loiter lasciviously. I want to see it all, and so you see, I take picture after picture and find a rock to fit my pocket. The pit stops are always impossible to properly plunder. In truth, I'm a pack rat, and the impact of looking back amasses so much, it's immaterial. What holds it together, this horde of baubles overheaving, overseeving into boxes, stacked piles of soilless seeds and implied agates, see related search of jewel weed. Abated faces, surfaces, and instruments, let's not mince words. I overlord the lookout tower and the liquidation sale for the biblios, the mementos, really. If all must go, I'm going. At the overlook, I thought I took it in. The scenic view seduces the heliotrope with a split screen of gluttony and the need to eat light. Its viral litter of shimmer transfigures the single leaf into an infinitesimal pixel like a postcard from the solar plexus. Or did you mean solar power? Or photosynthesis? I meant in the pit of the sun's stomach. I meant the summit of a sunlit trinket. I meant summer. I meant so much that only a machine can see what I now mean. My eyes are lapidary, albeit with contrary lapses into indolent scratches, freer trillance, a trill here, a trill there, a glass-cut screech. A leak of brilliance trickling from the trapdoor doesn't alleviate the fact, the lack of it, or the fact that there's no such thing as a permanent gleam. It elopes slant-lies while I tweedledee, tweedledum, a twang on a twang and a strum on my C fiddle, C fiddlehead, C beyond the furled fronds. Allons-y, to the bijou. I use my interactive digital thumbprint prick to purify my archives with the prismatic, pastel, fiery parse of a burst bubble. I clear all. I search again. I commission a hit or miss question answer into the pixelated mist. Press enter. I must. I insist. Allow me. I've time to weave into the machine. I'm a missionary of immersion into the corybantic counterglow. I goldmine this tarot trove at introspection, await the blow of the dice throw, reckoning the revelation like a reel-to-reel, the engine's rev. What is real? No burial for the virtual, that's for sure. Tautened ad hoc gridlock en route to the vault, backtrack to Hades in a swift hover rhythm, brink-bound and unbinding, all but bereft of, the stupefied ebb of all, did it even exist? The idiot questions persist, invasive as a vignette of exhaust in the face, as in, furthermore, in the refinery of air, what's lost forever? Just by looking at it, the blue clear blur deranges, defragments, beclouds. But I decompose. One can't rewind the cloud's limbs after their bulbous liminal bodies have blast past you. What I meant was, everything fastens loosey-goosey, so haggardly in its here to hereafter, I haven't a here to affix it to. This truant appall has no glue, no entry into. In lieu of elucidating, I undo. I clear all. I search for seer because it seems you should see all, but you can't. You can't see all. Only the machine can see all, and it's almost there, idyllic in its cataclysmic, undimensional fabric. I'm barely there, threadbare. I'm tacit with incapacity, corrosive, chime shred, crammed, hardly a charmed stone. The search for seer, leads me back to my unatoned search for all things Orpheus. Orpheism, turn Orphic, Ovid's metamorphosis, poet, musician, prophet, subservient, impervious, melody. This, in turn, leads me back to my search for lyre, as ever, the tension and feathery exultation. I endeavor to pluck, implode, to play, to amplify, to dive, drive, die into the purifying tether of a funeral pyre, with reds opaque as a string theory, to glom the gem inside. Please enter. Can't you just see it? The incumbent smog is petulant as a pop-up ad. I might have meant smoke, but we've pollutants aplenty already, every Eurydice a miasmic puff. Never mind the rough, we've diamonds in the dark matter, the devourous dark, bogus as if obliterated into thin. In the untoward, rabid turbines, a vast dross conspires to make its own voice. It bears an illegible, see, illegitimate, birthmark, bickering in the feedback with its own static. Embossed with grit, the vice, the voice, bloats an electronic choke rhythm and a deviant gravel sizzle. In a backward embodiment or a disembodiment, a robotic Beelzebub beats its ether breath in a virtual lurk and with a see-through smirk says, "Search for me. I'm the liar you've been looking for." So, my poetry is experimental via exploiting various traditional poetic devices. In the next poem, I'm really trying to push language further by using broken up words for emphasis to enact the action that's depicted in the poem. Yeah. Oh, no, that's okay. Song. And so the vicious unceasing, the boomerang of the boondoggle, or the dog bodifying her bark. Buoyant with the arc of it, the back trail up to the neck tuft, the tush in a tail tremor, the paws applauding on pavement, the time click of unfurled claws, the ruck ruck cuss cuss batong tongue hurl rough tit way towards the toodle. The huff huff, a prey the heave, the huff ruff, our poodle implorates, inoculates her pomp at the impenetrable prey. La-di-da-di-day, hey. Harklets of arf-arf bits and alley-ooped riff fits, all looped and high-pitched. Erudite R's and rars and airs, half-spat rats, scallion scat, behemoth fidoing bows and wows, a bout of bonafide bunk harping from the inner wreath, all writhe, writhing, enrivened, revving, undemurring, derived from lay dodo, constantly re-arriving. Raison d'etre of the rivender, part woof and worsening, a tick, tick, ticker tape in the heft of the heartbeat, clefting and heckling, it ruminates, ribcaging the riot, all enthralled, all-alled, all emblazoning the thrust, ust feast, all embellishing the bliss of being the beast. Sub-Italian to the sound, the body embodies its bellow. It encores. A long-winded rancor war roared, cacophonied with a coda of creticore. The flesh subsists to an approximate source. It backs forth, infested with a fizz-fizz infinitesimal. The territorial, the intuitive all, yak-a-tick-tick. The intoned implode loads, then reloads until a ribbit, and so a ribbit reloads. The thrash dance grows hobbledy, hobbledy hoy and toyish, over in tune to the attack ack ack. All slackens. The jowls ajar jarring, agitated, over aureate, the order in a heat throb, throb robbing, gutted even of a gasp, our poodle breaks down into vitriol yips in a gravel hack, gruff jawments in a growl whine. She downbreaks further into simpering puddlement, siphons a fluke whimper and a jellied yammer, and jamma-fanged in sang-froid. She shimmies even further into a newfangled dominion, a sub-stupor of alert silence. The chain stymies the investigation. The canine skulks kitty-cornered in a collar. Decapo, and so on. Nebula-la-lacities. The impudence thus is the pastoral kin of pillow fluff, a pollinate fur, an unapologetic puff-puff, a ditter of dander ousted in the air, inebriated with white flight, limpid, lambent, lacelessly faceless, its flippancy fine-tuned with slow motion and a Darth demarcation. Ah, do. Indeed. The leaf is non-lexical. It falls. Fa-la, fa-la, ha-ha, ha-ha. Do-wa plopped from the tee-tee tree. Tee-hee, tee-hee. Do-re, me, 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 me. Self-same and insisting, the shaft of the taunt ignites her entirely. The muzzle is makeshift, an undue ta-ta, an appetite of the tired body. The enticement steadies, tra-la-las in the eyes. Across the lawn is a presence only she can see. It tinkers, telltale with a tick-tock lock. She outwardly all but unexalts. She disembarks. She waits. She waits. Thank you. I did bring one drawing that I worked on while I was here, and I would, if you'd like to see it, I will put it out here, and I invite you to come look at it. Thank you.
Open mic coming up next, and
Yeah. I should make it a full house.